Hello, this is episode 40 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Gary Kushner, partner at Hogan Lovells Law Firm in Washington, D.C. How are you doing today, Gary?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. So I'd like to start off with the first question. What are you currently doing, or what have you ever done, to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, I try to do a lot of things to advance the public interest. Actually, it's always been my goal in life. It sounds presumptuous, but it's been my goal in life to make a difference mm-hmm. in the world. So whether it's been professional affiliations or affiliations with private groups, not-for-profits, or just friends and acquaintances, I've tried to engage in things that I believe make a difference in the world in a positive way. The last 40 years, I've represented the food industry.
Yeah.
And in my 40 years representing the food industry, my practice has been in two particular areas, two mm-hmm. general areas. One is in the area of legislation and rulemaking,
mm-hmm.
Trying to help shape the laws and policies to ensure the safe production of food,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully the production of affordable food that's abundant and available around the world. And in that capacity, I've represented mostly trade associations and companies in trying to influence regulation and legislation. But the other side of my practice has been advising companies on regulatory compliance. So once those laws are passed, the regulations are implemented to make sure companies know how to comply with them in a way that, again, ensures that the products they're producing are safe, wholesome, and abundantly available.
So how did you get interested in the food industry in particular? Was it something that was intellectually interesting to you, something you fell into, or did you really think that high quality foods was something that was important to advance for the population?
Totally an accident. Mm-hmm. I clerked for a trial judge after I graduated from law school and thought I wanted to be a criminal lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Went to look for a job with a state's attorney or a U.S. attorney's office or a litigation firm, and it was during the recession in 1976 when I finished my clerkship. There weren't a lot of jobs available, at least for someone who's just like me and sort of an average guy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the firms I interviewed with sent my resume over to a trade association representing the grocery industry.
Hmm.
They were at that time looking for a young lawyer to come in and review legislation and regulation and work with the lobbyists. So I didn't even know what a trade association was. I had no interest in the job, but I needed a job. So I figured, well, I'll do it for a year, and if I don't like it, it's just another stamp on my card. Mm-hmm. And if I do like it, well, all the better. And I loved it right away. I was fascinated. I realized it was diverse, the work, that I would actually be involved in policy. I was a political science major as an undergraduate and always active politically, and thought this would be an interesting way to get involved. And I really, really took a liking to the people I was working with, mm-hmm. to the companies I was working with. They were very high quality, smart people, motivated people. And I saw that there was an opportunity for me to take that and build a practice, and that's what I've done for the last 40 years.
Have you ever seen how the work that you do actually impacts people? Have you seen making a safer chicken product or a safer vegetable product or something like that has actually led to improved public health or reduced obesity? How have you seen the impact of your work?
Well, for one thing, I see innovative products on the marketplace all the time,
mm-hmm.
and I know that I helped get those products on the marketplace by getting new technologies approved by FDA or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, helping companies develop those products through intellectual property as well as sort of regulatory considerations. So I see a variety of products on the market, and nowadays you'll see more and more products that companies are designing with clean labels, as they call them, fewer additives, fewer chemicals,
mm-hmm.
With reduced fat, reduced sodium, improved fiber, and the like. So I see it on the marketplace. Hopefully that's affecting world health. Certainly there are a lot of things that affect health, and not the least of which is exercise and modern medicine. But I think a good variety of foods that are designed with strictest compliance with regulation contributes to that. More recently, over the past 2 years, I've been working with the world cocoa industry with a focus on trying to ensure sustainability of cocoa within the world. And we've been working primarily in West Africa with Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, where about 70% of the world's cocoa is produced. Our initiatives have been primarily in working with farmers in those communities to improve their lifestyle, to help them make more money, to provide inputs for crops and technology, and also to build schools in those areas in hopes that those people stay in cocoa farming, that their family wants to stay in cocoa farming, and that it provides a good living for them. So I'm seeing my effect on the world in a slightly different way, but again, all within the food industry.
So there is a parent company that is either owns a company that owns the cocoa or is purchasing the cocoa and seeks to import the cocoa into the United States, and you help them comply with American law. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. Yes, that's certainly the case, but the organization that I'm representing is the World Cocoa Foundation, which is a not-for-profit charitable organization that is supported by cocoa and chocolate companies who pay their dues on it and who work collectively to improve the lives of the people who are ultimately supplying them cocoa beans.
So I guess what you're doing is helping everybody. It's kind of like a win-win situation. You're helping companies be more profitable. And you're also helping some of those profits, some sustainable methods, some profits be reinvested in sustainable methods that are benefiting the communities that are producing the product that makes the company more profitable. Is that correct?
Well, and I'm also helping keep the price of cocoa down by helping farmers be that much more productive on the farm, increasing their yields because they're using more modern technology and more modern methods of agriculture.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about what your community really is about. Obviously, you live in Potomac, Maryland. You work in Washington, D.C., but it seems like you have an impact in China and in West Africa. You kind of have a global sense of a community, and in a sense, you have, I'm not sure if you would say local ownership, but you certainly are trying to make communities around the world, improve communities around the world. How would you reflect upon what sort of communities you belong in and why, how you're able to identify with communities so far away and contribute so much to help their communities?
Well, I will do that. I do want to say, if appropriate, later in the discussion to talk about another community to which I belong, which is the Jewish community, in which I'm very much involved in, what I consider to be very, very important public policy work, but focusing on Israel. We can come back to that in a minute. As for my work in the food industry, food is the food market is a global market, increasingly, and it is manufactured all over the world. It is imported, exported, distributed all over the world. It has become very much a global marketplace. I live in Bethesda, Maryland, which I enjoy very much, but the reality is I live there because of its proximity to Washington, D.C., where so much of my work is focused, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Congress, trade associations that I represent, whose members are manufacturers, distributors, retailers of food of every sort, are primarily located in the Washington area. So that's why I live here, that's why I work here, and I'm very much a part of the Washington community, if you will. But wherever I go, whatever I do, it's affecting people all over the world. I travel about 200,000 miles a year, I guess, and have visited just about any country. There are a lot of places yet to visit, but I visited a lot of them. I've been in food plants. I just came back from a week in China, where I first attended a global food safety summit. Representatives from all over the world. There were about 1,000 people there talking about food safety. And then I conducted seminars on U.S. food law for Chinese exporters, food exporters. One seminar in our Beijing office and one seminar in our Shanghai office. So it is an international network that I belong to.
So what's the relationship between doing well and doing good? Obviously, your clients hire you to help to improve their business processes, to increase their profitability. But on the other hand, you spoke about how you're trying to do good in the world. What's the correlation between the two?
Well, first of all, most people like to do well. I've got three kids, and thankfully they're good kids, and they're all doing fine. Mm-hmm. But a little help from dad has certainly been valuable in their life and continues to be valuable. And we live a very nice life. We're very blessed. Mm-hmm. Practicing law, I've often said, is a very hard way to make a very good living. Hmm. At the same time, I have never been one who was driven by the dollar mm-hmm. or by a fancy car. My drive has always been to make a difference in the world.
Hmm.
For whatever reason, that's my makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And my clients know that. Mm-hmm. My clients, some of whom I've represented for 35, 36 years consistently, mm-hmm. they know who I am, and they know that my goal is to help them do well, help them make a profit, help them stay in business. But at the same time, they also know that I truly believe that good business means doing good things for the community, making a quality product, being proud of it, mm-hmm. making a safe product. If they do that, they are going to do well financially, and they are going to be sustainable as a business in and of themselves. So I've never been shy about telling a company where I thought they could do a better job, or where I thought they were getting a little close to the line,
mm-hmm.
or where I thought cutting corners was not in their long-term interest.
So do they ever hesitate to go to you, and then maybe they go to someone else if there's an ethically ambiguous situation, or do they ever kind of try to push you to do something, and then you have to say, look, I can't really work for you anymore? Have you ever had a situation like that?
I put my feet in my clients' shoes, and they know it. I'm a counselor,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not a shy counselor. I've spent a lot of years building credibility with them.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most part, when I tell them what I think they need to do, mm-hmm. they appreciate that advice, and they know it's in their self-interest. Do I have clients who push back? Of course. And will I push back at them? Of course. I have, in 40 years, lost very, very few clients. And there have been companies I've told that unless they see it my way, I don't want to work for them. There have been a few that have gone other places, and I've been just as happy.
So if I understand you correctly, you differentiated between short-term profitability and long-term profitability, whereas you designated the latter, long-term profitability, as more worthwhile in the long run, and that in order to get there, doing good, being ethical, treating their product sources fairly and equitably will be more profitable in the long run. Would you agree with that assessment?
Not only would I agree with that assessment, but I believe my clients in the food industry in the mainstay would agree with that assessment as well.
Interesting. So to be profitable in the long run is to be ethical throughout the course of your business is to be on the path towards long-term profitability.
Yes.
Okay.
I agree. I think success, no matter what you do,
mm-hmm.
in any walk of life, mm-hmm. success depends upon honesty and ethical behavior and mm-hmm. thinking long-term.
Great. So I want to return to the other community to which you belong. You have long been involved with the Jewish National Fund. Please tell us a little bit about why you've been involved, why it's important to you, and what you've been doing.
Be glad to. I grew up in a very small town where there were very few Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced anti-Semitism at a very young age.
Hmm.
It took me a long time to understand it,
mm-hmm.
And not to appreciate it, but I say to understand what sometimes motivated people to act the way they did. When I had the opportunity and reached a point in my life where I could afford the time and the energy and the money mm-hmm. to participate in an organization that would help reduce, mm-hmm. Hopefully, or fight anti-Semitism, or for that matter, hatred, discrimination in any form, mm-hmm. I got involved in the Anti-Defamation League. Mm-hmm. And I was on ADL's board for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
In that capacity, I met a man named Jan Karski.
Hmm.
Who was known as, and a book was written about him, as the man who tried to stop the Holocaust. Dr. Karski, who in his later years wound up as a professor in Georgetown University Foreign Service School,
mm-hmm.
had been a messenger in exile in the Polish government during World War II. And he actually was smuggled into and out of concentration camps. came, met with President Roosevelt and Churchill, and told them about the concentration camps. And what Dr. Karski, who was not Jewish, by the way, very, very observant Catholic, said more than once, and stuck with me, is there will never be another Holocaust so long as there's an Israel. So I moved from the Anti-Defamation League to the Jewish National Fund, that has as its primary function for the last 100 years, actually since 1901, raising money to purchase land and build infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and make life better for residents of Israel, to build that country. And it's an, if you've not been there, and I know you have, it's an extraordinary country that I now have the privilege of visiting about twice a year. I'm currently president of the Washington area of Jewish National Fund, and I see where my money goes there, and I feel a tremendous amount of satisfaction and reward from the work I'm doing.
So why, I'd like to speak a little bit about your connection to Israel. It's interesting, you know, there are 7 billion people in the world, and you know, not a lot of people are investing in Cambodia or Sri Lanka. You know, there are many places in the world, and you know, there are a lot of places that have greater needs than Israel, Israel being a developed nation. You feel, most people don't do very much with other, to help other communities on the other side of the globe. Yet you feel a connection and an affinity towards a community who happened to be Jewish, just like you, on the other side of the globe. Why is it you feel this special connection and affinity to this land that you go to initially as a tourist, but you're not a citizen of the country, you don't live there? Why is it that you care so much about helping this community to which you feel you belong to, but you're not physically in most of the time?
You know, when I visit Israel and I talk to Israelis and I say, I feel bad, I come over here and act like it's my place, that I have an ownership interest here. Yet I don't. I've not fought in the IDF. I've not had to pay your taxes. I've not had to live in an environment where I'm surrounded by enemies. Mm-hmm. And I say, I feel bad that, that I should be so presumptuous as to think I have an ownership interest. And their answer is, all Jews have an ownership interest in Israel. Whether you live here or not, Israel is part of you. We need you. You need us. Again, I grew up in an anti-Semitic environment. Mm-hmm. Jews have been chased out of lots of places over lots of centuries, lots of millennia, for mm-hmm. that matter. Somehow, our culture has survived. And I think one of our reasons our culture has survived in the diaspora as well as in Israel mm-hmm. is because we understand, we do feel like we are a people. Mm-hmm. And Israel does need our help. Israel is, there's 8 million people living in Israel. 6.5 million, I guess, are Jewish. Mm-hmm. The others are Muslim, Christian, non-believers, mm-hmm. you name it, all of whom are welcome. Mm-hmm. But they need us, and frankly, Jews are going to take care of Israel. There aren't a lot of people who are not Jewish who will take care of Israel for the very point you make, and that is there are other countries and other organizations that need and deserve their help. So we need to all help where we feel we're most needed and where we can make the most difference in, the, in where we can most relate to what the people are doing and the, what the people need.
Can you foresee a time at any point in the future, name a number, add it to whatever today's date is, can you see a time at any point in the future where it is presently in 2016 safe to be a Jew? Can you imagine at any point in the future where that same place will become unsafe for a Jew, and that person, and that, and the descendants of that person might need a refuge in the state of Israel?
Absolutely. Just look around the world. What has happened in France, where there's been so much anti-Semitism? Synagogues have been battered. People have been battered, and Jews have moved out. Mm-hmm. Take a look at even in Brussels, where I go quite often for my work. Mm-hmm. In Brussels, Belgium, there have been significant anti-Semitic incidents. I visited a Jewish museum in Brussels probably a year or two ago, right after there had been an attack on that museum. Mm-hmm. And now there were two guards standing outside that museum with automatic guns, mm-hmm. assault weapons. Mm-hmm. Yes, call me paranoid if you want, or call me realistic. I've read enough. And I know, I've seen enough of where Jews have have thought they lived in a safe environment, and all of a sudden they don't. Hopefully that will never be fully the case in the United States. I think we have something unique here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as did Dr. Jans, Dr. Korsky, who's since passed away,
mm-hmm.
There will never be a Holocaust so long as there's an Israel, because there will always be a home for Jews. There were incidents, you probably are aware of them, during World War II. There was one ship, the name of which I'm embarrassed that I cannot remember, of Jews escaping Germany
mm-hmm.
who came to America, and America would not accept them, Cuba would not accept them. They went back to Germany and they were executed. They were annihilated. So, you know, I'm just one who believes very strongly that in the need for a Jewish homeland.
So on this topic, you mentioned the Anti-Defamation League, also referred to as the ADL.
Right.
They produced a survey recently in the last few years about anti-Semitism around the world.
Right.
And one of the conclusions of that survey is that a significant number of people around the world have an impression that Jews may have more loyalty to Israel than to their native country. Some of our listeners may not be Jews, may not even have met a Jew. Could you elaborate a little bit about the affinity and loyalty you feel for the United States, being an American citizen, and how that compares to your loyalty or interest in the state of Israel?
Well, first of all, I'm aware of the ADL study because I've been on the board of ADL and on their executive committee and was vice chairman up until I got so involved with JNF.
Mm-hmm.
And they do extraordinarily good work.
Mm-hmm.
And the study was very well done. And I'm answering your question in the reverse way. I am a Jew. I'm very committed to being a Jew,
mm-hmm.
but I'm also an American, and I try very hard to make a difference in America as well, in my community. I don't think that they're at all exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, I do believe that a lot of people who will say Jews are loyal to Israel, they're not loyal to the United States, that I find that to be a bit of a cop-out.
Mm-hmm.
And I find there is a inherent anti-Semitism in that perception,
and
or
would
at least
you
the expression of that perception.
And would you say that perception is incorrect?
I would say that perception is incorrect, but I would say that perception is more widely held than we'd like to admit.
Okay. So let's see here. So we're nearing the end of the podcast, and I'd like to reflect a little bit on your work, which has been so varied. Now, for our listeners, just to elucidate Gary's situation, he is non-remunerated for his work with the Anti-Defamation League and the Jewish National Fund. So he's very active in these nonprofit organizations and advocacy and philanthropy. And yet, in his professional career, he has always made it a priority to make sure that profits are accompanied by an ethical sensibility. Can you reflect a little bit on your career and your philanthropy and really your motivations? Why is it, I'm sure you may have run across one person in the course of your career who doesn't share your same consideration for ethical values, who doesn't feel obliged to be as philanthropic as you are. Why is it that you do what you do?
Because I am who I am. And yes, I've encountered people who don't give to charities, who make more money than I do, who have more money to spread around, and God bless them. That's their business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not looking to be judged nor to judge them.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with certain basic values,
mm-hmm.
and one of my basic values was live a good life, live by the golden rule, treat others as you would have others treat you,
mm-hmm.
do good things, and you will be rewarded. I've been handsomely rewarded. I've got a wonderful family.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a wonderful career. I make a very good living, and it is a privilege for me to give back, and that being able to make a good living has enabled me to give back in terms of time and money. As I get closer to retirement, however that's defined, I hope to give more time than money, because I'm going to, as my wife puts it, it's great that you do all this work, and she's very committed to JNF and to ADL, but she points out every once in a while that I pay them, they don't pay me.
Yeah.
My answer is indeed they do pay me. The rewards and the satisfaction I get from meeting people in Israel, seeing bridges that we built, seeing hospitals that we built, helping people who are disabled go to parks and have accessibility, the rewards I get are immeasurable, certainly cannot be counted in dollars.
So Gary Kushner, an attorney at Hogan Lovells, speaks about a remuneration that is not just monetary, but that there can be other forms of compensation, spiritual forms, forms of fulfillment, and that there is more to life than merely getting by and making a profit and being successful, but really having an impact. And for those of you who are parents out there, or children, of course, of parents, think about the values that you're imparting to your children and how those they will be carried forward throughout the rest of your children's life, and really taking ownership and understanding that it is not a mutually exclusive arrangement when you consider profitability and doing good. Doing good and doing well can be done simultaneously, and as Mr. Kushner has shown us, his clients do appreciate his ability to merge good and well. So this has been episode 40 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.